Hello, this is EO Books Broadcasting, and today we have with us Kai Longfellow, the author of The Secret Magdalene. Welcome, Kai.
Hi.
Kai, would you like to take a moment and tell us about your book?
That's a very big question. Would you like to give me something specific to work with?
Why don't you just tell us a little about the story that you've written?
The problem with answering a question like that is that you work very, very hard on a story, and to summarize it in an interview does it no justice whatsoever. It's basically a midrash, which is a Jewish word for making myth out of myth, which is something we all do and have done from the dawn of time. I'm a storyteller, and when I tell stories, I want my stories to be as grounded in worldly reality as possible. So I research everything from what people wore to what they ate to what possible historicity I can find. And there was a lot of it. There was a lot of research to do for a book that I chose to do about Mary Magdalene. And I chose Mary Magdalene out of pure innocence. I had no idea at the time that I chose her, that she was a popular subject, or was going to be a popular subject. Dan Brown's book hadn't come out at that time, and I was working in what essentially was a vacuum of biblical scholars whose books were all over the place in trying to determine and answer the questions that everyone seems to have now about whether Jesus truly existed. If he did, who was he? And what, basically, was he trying to say to us? And the part that interested me the most was, what was Jesus's original teachings? And I wanted to slant that from the point of view of Mary Magdalene, who at the time that I started knew absolutely nothing about, except that she was considered a prostitute and a fallen woman and a penitent who followed Jesus around and who was there, who witnessed his resurrection. During the course of my research, this view of Mary Magdalene was revolutionized for me in the most extraordinary ways. I am left with none of these feelings. All my original feelings, my original ideas, everything I went into this book with were forcibly changed by what I learned through not just going back through Catholicism or Christianity, but Judaism. And even those things that were written by later Arabic thinkers and poets and historians. So I came at it from every direction I could. It took me 7 years in order to write about these people and to come to the original teachings. And when I found the original teachings, then I knew what the heart of my book was, which I did not know when I started. And the heart of my book is something called gnosis. And so for you to ask me what the book is about, it's about a story most people know, certainly the Western world is dominated by this story. And I've taken it and used it like everyone used it, from the Bible through each and every church father, from storytellers from the time they first heard it to various novelists, and I too have chosen to use it in order to voice something important to me, which was the understanding of gnosis.
Well then, why don't you tell us a little bit more about gnosis and what that means to you? Why was it important to you to describe gnosis through this story?
Because gnosis is not a thing, and it's not a teaching, it's an experience. And it's an experience all mystics have, and that's what makes them mystics, to have this experience. It's available to everyone. It's their inner divinity. And it's been denied to the West for 1600 years, ever since the Catholic Church was made the Church of Rome, because gnosis is an individual experience and cannot be guided or given to you or bequeathed to you, or you cannot pray enough for it through a priesthood or a papacy. And anyone who wants to create a religion does not want freedom of thought and freedom of reaching God without any kind of intermediary whatsoever to exist, because they cannot be, create a church in that way. Gnosis is something that is part of the human experience from the beginning of humanity. It's a personal, direct, and individual connection with what people call God, which is a difficult word because it gives, it conjures up a being. Well, I'm not referring to a being when I say God. I'm referring to consciousness itself. It's the direct connection with divine consciousness. And when that happens to a person, and it can happen to anyone, it can even happen spontaneously, much less to those who go deliberately throughout their life seeking it. When that happens, they understand the world, and they are no longer afraid before the terrors that life seems to bring us. And this is our birthright. And Jesus was teaching this, that the kingdom of God is here. It's not somewhere else that one merits or deserves and reaches when you're dead. It can be and is always here. It's reality, actually. It's consciousness is reality. The church tells us and tells us that this is, you know, they don't even talk about it, actually. There is no personal experience of Gnosis in our Western belief system. They removed it from our Western belief system. Unlike the Eastern belief system, where it's called, most people would call it enlightenment. Gnosis or enlightenment does not make a person suddenly a better person or a superior person or a person who is perfect in any way. It simply relieves that person of the fear of life. There's nothing to fear in life. It gives that person a grounding in bliss and beauty and the understanding that all is as it should be, and that all our lives are blessed and we are all part of the Godhead. What a lovely thought, and what a liberating thought. And that's what Jesus tried to teach, but his teachings were simply ignored by the church, actually, who taught what they felt like teaching and put things in Jesus' mouth and interpreted in such a way that we've lost all of it. I wanted to talk about that and to bring it back.
So, if I understand you, you were interested in Gnosis, and you chose the New Testament story of Jesus' teaching work to describe Gnosis.
Yes, and I did that because, for me, it's not an academic issue. It's a real issue, because I have to confess, even though that confession is difficult, simply because people misinterpret it eternally. I confess that I have experienced a moment of Gnosis. I haven't been able to hold on to it, nor was I willing to hold on to it in order to live my life. But it certainly came to me unexpectedly when I was very young, and I have. One of the most telling thing about Gnosis is that, although throughout life, no matter what happens to you, you question everything. You're not sure of anything. When you are in a state of Gnosis, you question nothing. You know, which is what Gnosis means. To know, basically, it's to know the divine. It's not just to know something. It's not just knowledge. It's knowledge of the divine. There is no question left. You're safe. There's nothing that can hurt you. You're eternal. Your point of view is forever. And you will never die, and you are as much God is God, as everything is God. And you know this. And if we all knew this, my God, the world, how changed the world would be.
Well, now in your story, Jesus is not only inspired with revelations from God, But he is also taught philosophy by two of his disciples, Mary Magdalene, disguised as a male youth, John, and Seth. Who is this Jesus?
Historically or mythically, the way I'm using him?
Well, now, you have created a Jesus in your story.
Yes.
And this Jesus was taught by two of his disciples some philosophy.
Yes.
And this is not really the Jesus that we're all familiar with from the New Testament story. So I wonder if you could talk about who the Jesus is that you were writing about.
Well, I was writing about a Jesus of his times, a person set, you know, a person who really might well have existed, and to know the time in which he existed is to know who he might have been. The Bible gives so little background to what to their stories about Jesus. You have no idea. He seems like a man living in a peaceable kingdom, but sad and without doctors and without ability to communicate rapidly, and so he simply told great masses of people parables, and we have no idea until we begin to study what was actually going on in the world of the Middle East in the time of Jesus. It was a fervent, broiling cauldron of revolutionary fervor. Rome had stamped itself all over the world at that, the known world at that time, and very much in Jerusalem. They were in their holy city. They were, nothing could be done without their control and their say-so. The emperor was in complete control of the Judaic temple, and it caused, as it's causing in the Middle East right now, I mean, the idea of zealotry is nothing new. There is nothing changed from that day to this except the names of the characters. It was a swarm with various sects, all furious at Rome, furious at their own priests for conniving with Rome, because Rome kept the priests in their power and kept the temple. They were, their own king, Herod, wasn't even Jewish. He was Arabic. And they wanted, and he tried, Herod tried very hard to solicit and to win the hearts of the Jews. He built them a temple. It took 40 years. He was dead before it was finished. But it didn't help whatsoever. The zealotry of the Jews grew and grew during this time. Any thinking man of that age, anyone who was religious, and of course religiousness used to be much more prevalent in a person, well, it's as prevalent as it is today in the Middle East. You know, religion, theocracy, is a part of everyone's life and everyday life, unlike the Western world and Europe and America, which it's faded from over the last 100 years. Religion was extremely important, and they were absolutely furious, and they went around doing precisely what they're doing today, but without the technology. They don't blow things up because they didn't have gunpowder. They stabbed people and ran away. It's called terrorism. And as far as I can tell from all my research, it's very conceivable, since Jesus was surrounded by disciples who are known Sicarii, which is a zealotry group. Sicarii is based on Sika, which is a Persian dagger. These people carried knives, and so they were called knife men or dagger men or the Sicarii, which is very interestingly close to the word Iscariot, because no Bible scholar knows what Iscariot actually means. But how curious that it's incredibly similar to the word Sicarii. He was, in the Bible itself, it says that a couple of them, of his disciples, were actual zealots. If Jesus was followed around by zealots, it's quite possible that Jesus himself began as a zealot. Jesus, I believe, from all that I've researched, and if not true, then it's certainly true in my book that Jesus began.
Well, now, if I may interrupt, I was asking about your Jesus, because
My Jesus is a zealot. My Jesus was a young man who was raised in a family of carpenters. Carpentry was not such a humble thing at that time, and that many things were being built because Tiberius, who being emperor at the time, was rebuilding cities all over, and these cities needed lots and lots of carpenters, journeyman carpenters, who were paid fairly well. So if Jesus and his family were carpenters, they were, you know, and they live right next to a new building town, Sepphoris, they could easily have gotten well-paying jobs to be carpenters. So I would imagine they were not terribly poor, not rich by any means, but not poor. And they would also be, all these towns that Jesus grew up near were centers of Hellenistic cosmopolitan thought. Something, again, they don't tell you in the Bible is that these people could have been educated at least by hearsay, by listening to all the things that were going on. Greeks lived everywhere. Persians lived everywhere. There was a mixture of cultures. There were Hellenistic Jews who no longer catered so much to the law. There was, it was like living in New York. You know, people from everywhere.
It was a cosmopolitan world.
Quite cosmopolitan. What you'd find is like one village would be totally under the rule of the law. And then the very next village would be a village devoted to Artemis. And the next village would be devoted to something entirely different, usually an Hellenistic or a Greek idea. Some were completely Roman. You could wander from place to place and find yourself amongst people speaking different languages. And at that time, the lingua franca had become Greek. So Greeks, the Greek language and the Greek ideas were everywhere. Another reason why zealots were so crazy, because they were challenging the temple and challenging the law. Certain amounts of Jews hated that. Again, there are parallels all over the Middle East today in the Muslim world, having Western ideas impinge on ancient traditions. Well, this is Greek ideas and Roman ideas impinging on relatively ancient tradition, because the Jews aren't as old as all that. So Jesus is in this world, and if Jesus is in this world, then he must have been affected by this world. He could have been all sorts of different things. He could have been half-educated, just by hearsay. He could have learned to read, although most people did not read and write at that time, but it's not untoward that he might have been able to. We don't know. My Jesus does not read nor does he write, but he is very intelligent. And an intelligent man, when he's very, very young and surrounded by zealotry, would probably be a zealot. And he was certainly surrounded by men who were known zealots. So I concluded he was a zealot. But that there was something more to Jesus than that. He was a born Gnostic. He had experienced Gnosticism, or moments of Gnosis. I shouldn't call it Gnosticism. Gnosticism is something that developed from Gnosis, the word, not the idea or the feeling, just the word. And so I will say he had experienced Gnosis, in my book, as a young child, which is typical of mystics, but had ignored it because no one else knew what he was talking about, and tried to get on with his life without thinking about these things. But as life progressed for him, these moments became more and more pressing upon his consciousness and confused him and upset him and made him face perhaps what he was born to do, which was to be a teacher of Gnosis, not a zealot, because Gnosis would never teach one to kill for a god, or that violence would answer any question or any situation. But it took Jesus for quite some time to learn this. And he's helped in his learning by my main character, Mary Magdalene, who's highly educated.
Which brings up what I consider a very interesting question. Your Mary Magdalene is very different from what one would expect from reading the New Testament Gospels. Where did you find the inspiration to create your Mary Magdalene?
From not just the New Testament Gospels, although there are hints in those Gospels. Tremendous hints that should never be ignored. The most important person in Jesus' life turns out to be Mary Magdalene. She witnessed the risen Christ. That's outrageously important and yet ignored. Why did the writers of the Synoptic Gospels put Mary Magdalene at that moment? Why did they choose her when they could have chosen a male? Or any of his disciples, yet they chose her. There's a reason for that. But mostly I discovered her in the Gnostic Gospels, which were discovered in 1945 in Nag Hammadi, Egypt. Anyone, any biblical scholar can tell you about these much better than I can. But in these, Mary Magdalene gets a great deal of mention. I also found historical, not just mythological or storytelling, indications that there was a woman called Mariamne, written in historical records by Origen, O-R-I-G-E-N, mentioning a Mariamne who was the leader of a sect at that time, in the early days when women were not just parts, or not just disciples, not even just bishops in the early church, they were leaders of churches. And this is historically mentioned here and there throughout early writings. I also put together the fact that if she was in this position, there certain things had to be true about her. She had to be, and there were commonly well-to-do women who, because of their wealth, could release themselves a certain amount from their own culture, because wealth always gives one much more freedom of choice in every culture to do what she liked, rather than be required to marry, or rather to be required to stay in her home. She could easily travel, and women did. She could easily teach, and women did. She could support prophets, and women did. And she could also have traveled anywhere she liked and gone to any school she liked if she had the money. And there were women who did. There were women teachers all throughout. What you don't know is they don't get mentioned. They certainly don't get mentioned in the Bible. They don't get mentioned too often in histories. But if you dig enough, there's women everywhere. Women, you know, a woman taught Socrates. A woman taught Pythagoras. Pythagoras left his teachings and his, he didn't form a church, so I can't say that, his school to his wife and his daughter, not to some male student. He left it to his wife and his daughter to carry on. These things get ignored. Women's names get eradicated from the record, but not completely, and people are digging them up and you can find them. And so for Mary Magdalene to be an educated, wealthy woman with an independent mind is not at all inconceivable. And for her to have met a man like Jesus, who was a zealot, gradually questioning and wondering, and if he was insane, thanks to his visions and to his increasingly prevalent moments of gnosis, would have also been quite possible. I wove them all together into a story I wanted to tell. I used these people, as they have been used many times before, to talk about what I wanted to talk about, and what I believe is a spiritual truth. I never claim that it's a true truth, or a historical truth, or a kind of truth most people think truth is. Most people think truth equates with facts. But that's not true, in my opinion. Truth can be spiritual, it can be psychological, it can have nothing to do with facts. My story is true. Real is another matter, factual is another matter.
Now, in the gospel stories that we have from the New Testament Bible, Mary Magdalene is characterized as a fallen woman or a prostitute. In your book, you do talk a bit about the culture in which Mary Magdalene is living, but can you say a little more about why your Mary Magdalene doesn't seem to fall into that category?
Well, for one thing, hardly anyone who's a biblical scholar or a thinking Christian no longer believes that Mary Magdalene was a prostitute. Those who don't question their faith probably still think so. Even the church in 1969 finally changed that category for her. I mean, they were pressured into it, but for 1358 years, I think, from Pope Gregory the Great, who declared and conflated her with three or two other women in the Bible, he decided that each of these women was the same woman, which is the penitent whore. There's a story of a penitent whore who comes and washes Jesus' feet. Then there's a story about Mary of Bethany, and then there's the Mary Magdalene. And he declared, with no basis, even from the Gospels, with no basis for it at all, to conflate these three women into one woman, which he declared to be Mary Magdalene. And at that point, she was then made in to the penitent prostitute. There is no mention of any such thing in the New Testament. You can read all of it. There's not one word that says Mary Magdalene was a prostitute. This comes 1358 years ago, back in 1969. So what, at 50, in the sixth century, he declared this and to be a truth, and it became Christian dogma and rapidly gained a great deal of popularity because, oh gosh, there's so many reasons why, and there's so many people who have written their various reasons why, one of which is that it made her a pin-up girl. There's no time when people aren't interested in sex. Not one, you know, and to have a sexy woman suddenly involved in one's church tales wasn't a thing to be given up lightly. She was then painted constantly by various painters, and which is an interesting point. Whenever someone writes about Mary Magdalene, they go, oh no, another book about Mary Magdalene. Well, certainly people didn't say that about, oh gee, another painting of Mary Magdalene. There's hundreds of paintings of Mary Magdalene by artists obscure to famous forever. Mary Magdalene was an extremely popular subject because it allowed men to paint their ideal woman, which was sexual. It gave them an opportunity to have an unclothed woman. Oh gosh, but even deeper and more profound, it gave people the idea, and a wonderful idea, by the way, that they could, no matter how bad a person they had been, they could be redeemed through the church. This is a very comforting feeling to people who feel so guilty about their lives. And then there's the third thing about Mary Magdalene being a prostitute, which is basically it's totally a mythic truth of Sapphira, the fallen one, which is a Gnostic used in the proper way, not Gnosis, but Gnostic idea of cosmology, how the world works, and that Mary, who is Sapphira, who is wisdom, was the female principle that created the world from consciousness. And she came into this world and lost herself. And during that period, so therefore she was fallen. So in a way, Gregory, without knowing it, accurately gave her back her myth, which is the myth of Sapphira. It's funny and it's ironic if people understood that they were talking about myth. And Sapphira is rescued by her partner, her soul partner, her platonic double, who is in Gnosticism the Christ. And the Christ, of course, is the principle of Gnosis itself. She's rescued by the realization that she's not trapped, that she's not fallen, and that reality is illusory. And she goes back to source. It's a marvelous story. And that's, you could see the penitent or the whore as being a marvelous story if you understood it that way. So I'm not dismayed by Mary Magdalene having gone through this process of being a prostitute all this time. And although I used to be, before I studied everything, I used to be angry that men treated women like this, that men's stories denigrated or marginalized her. And of course, who knows exactly what they were thinking when they did that, but psychically what they did was tap right in to her actual meaning mythologically, which is curious, don't you think, how things work?
Yes, that's very interesting. And brings up a question I'd like to ask. Your book has been endorsed by recognized biblical scholars for the quality of your research, and I'm wondering if there were any surprising discoveries you made during the course of your research.
Oh my God, yes. Lots and lots and lots and lots, but some of it was purely intuitive. And the first thing that occurs to me is not so much what I discovered that surprised me, because I came to it with certain preconceived ideas, as we all do when we approach a subject we know nothing about. The surprises that I discovered are surprises that are discovered daily by scholars all the time. But what's the most amazing surprise for me is I didn't discover it at all. I simply intuited it and put it into my book because it made story sense. It made psychological sense. I made my Judas a twin of Yeshua, his absolute best friend, his soul, everything. Judas and Jesus were everything to each other. And when Judas betrayed Jesus, he did it as his part of Jesus' intent towards raising the consciousness of the people. And Judas, in that way, is as much a hero and as much to be, oh God, loved and admired as Jesus was himself in my book. And then it was written, whoa, I finished writing this book, oh gosh, 4 years ago, I suppose. And what, a month ago, there has been notice in all the newspapers that they've discovered the Gospel of Judas, in which that's exactly what it's saying. I could not believe it. That was stunning. That wasn't something I discovered. It's just, it just happened, and it's like a little miracle in the book. There's other little moments like that throughout my book.
Quite a remarkable incident.
Oh gosh, yeah.
Coincidence is what I meant to say.
I don't think of it as a coincidence, but I understand that most people would.
Well, I enjoyed reading your book very much, and I wanted the opportunity to tell you that. And to sum up, I have a final question, which is, I'd like to know if you feel that the experience of writing The Secret Magdalene has changed you in any way, and how.
Yes, it has changed me enormously, because before this I felt an inferior writer, a good stylist, I admit that, but with nothing really to say. And that entertainment. And there's lots and lots and lots of us that are perfectly happy to be entertainers.
Perhaps I should mention at this point that you had previously published two other novels on very different...
Very different. Yes, every book I write is on a different topic. I can't stick with one topic. But I had fun writing them, but they weren't important, and in my opinion, and they weren't satisfying in my opinion. They weren't bad books. They were genuinely entertaining, and they stand up as entertainment and witty and funny. But with the Mary Magdalene, for whatever reason I decided to do this, my goodness, I found important. I found heart. I found my own heart, that I could actually talk about real feelings and really important things. And there's nothing more important than knowing what gnosis would tell you, which is that you are divine, that you are safe, that you don't need to be saved. There's no one trying to judge you, that whatever you do with your life is your life, and it's fine. And that you will live forever. And there is no... And forever means now. Physics knows this. It's now cutting edge of because philosophy has become physics. Most of our philosophers have moved out of the so-called world of philosophy, and now they're asking those philosophical questions in cutting-edge physics. You know, who am I? Where do we come from? This kind of thing. These are philosophical, traditionally philosophical questions, but they have now become quantum physics questions, and being answered in the most extraordinarily mystical ways. And it's very exciting, and so I learned so much from writing this book. So much, indeed, that I actually, for the first time ever, have not finished. I'm not finished with her. In my book, it ends when she's only, I think, 22, 23 years old. And she lives quite a little bit longer than that. And I want to go further with her, because originally it was just an ideal. Well, I could continue. But now I know I must. Her story's not finished for me.
So it sounds like you're talking about a sequel.
Yes, in a way. A sequel, it's really part and parcel of the same book, only cut in half, as they used to do to people like Thomas Wolfe. You know, he just kept writing the same book, and his editor would come take a chunk once in a while and go, let's publish this and give it a name. But it's all the same book. Just kept writing and writing and writing. This would be the same thing with the Magdalene.
So we can look forward to hearing more of Mary Magdalene's story
from you. Oh, yes. I've already begun.
Now, I think there's something stirring in the world today. Perhaps we could call it in a woman's movement, a looking for the feminine in spirituality and religion. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you would have anything to say about that in regards to your book.
Well, that's not what I was doing. But like any other woman, naturally, you can't help but be involved in feminism in some way or another, even if you're totally unaware of it or you're reactionary. You're still being a feminist of some sort. You're born a woman. You're a woman in a man's world. You can hardly help but express yourself in one way or the other that way. Through the writing Mary Magdalene, I was much more concerned with other aspects of her. But because I wrote her the way she did, she became very much a heroine for women. That wasn't an intention. That's just a result. Because she's an intelligent woman with her own mind in a world of men, just as we are today, only worse. You know, all ringed round with Jewish law and lack of freedom, worse than a slave, and thought of by men as no more than their horse. In fact, they love their horses more. A woman was not listened to, except, as I said earlier, there were exceptions, of course, and Mary Magdalene is one of those exceptions. So she becomes a voice for women very strongly in the book. How could she not? That wasn't my purpose, but it certainly turned out that way, and that's okay by me. My purpose was to talk about gnosis. But when you take on a subject like this, and in the way that I did, you end up talking about everything.
Now, your book will be published after, of course, The Da Vinci Code, which has been out for a couple of years now.
Oh, gosh.
And there are other books on Mary Magdalene that have been published.
Yes.
And so a great deal of interest in Mary Magdalene has been stirred in the public mind.
Yes.
And so there's almost a movement afoot in terms of discovering the secrets about Mary Magdalene. There's hints that perhaps there was a bloodline in France, and this is what the Da Vinci Code is about, in terms of Jesus perhaps having produced a child or children with Mary Magdalene. And then also Mary Magdalene has more or less been iconified as kind of a goddess figure for some people. Can you talk a bit about that and how that relates to your story?
Doesn't relate at all. I don't agree with any of it. I'm not interested in the Grail stories because all it does is make Mary Magdalene Mrs. Jesus. In other words, she's the vessel that carries Jesus's bloodline through his children. Mythologically, Margaret Starbird has written books talking about this. If you look at it symbolically, it makes the bride and the bridegroom and ancient myth, and touching back on gender issues that we are all, you know, that one needs the feminine as part of the masculine, and that's all very well and good, but really it reduces Mary to not a person in herself, not valuable in herself, certainly not a teacher, certainly not the woman who knew the all, as she's called in Gnostic texts. Any woman who knew the all is not Mrs. Jesus. And I really have no interest whatsoever in the possibility that there's a bloodline. If there's a bloodline, statistically speaking, there must be 40 million people who are now part Jews. Does this make them divine? Or more divine than the average human being? Does this impart to them some special wisdom or gifts? It's nothing. It means nothing. It has nothing to do with the Grail. And the Grail, by the way, is a mid. It's not even accurate in the sense that the Grail is a Middle Ages. It's taken by the Church as it took many things from many groups that it was overrunning, and it took Irish myth, which is where the Grail comes from, you know, the cup. And it could never have belonged to Jesus. We're talking 1,000 years later. And so if there's any Grail whatsoever, we're the Grail by sense of, you know, all of us can realize Gnosis, and all of us can know the kingdom of God. And bloodlines, and who married whom, if they married at all. And I'm not saying they didn't marry. I have no idea. It's not important to me. It's not important to my story. I'm not trying to make her Mrs. Jesus. I am trying to talk about philosophy and teaching and Gnosis and the psychology of these two people, these two glorious people who come together for this brief moment on this earth and find their Platonic other half, and through that live a life, and such an extraordinary life that's an inspiration to the world for all these 2,000 years, and to bring us back to what was important about that relationship, and what was important about what Jesus had to say, and where he got some of what he had to say, which is from her. And this you can find in the Gnostic Gospels. She taught him. He was a natural mystic, but she taught him how to place and to understand his visions.
Well, thank you for taking the time with us today, Kai. And, of course, as the original publishers of your book, The Secret Magdalene, we at EO Books are very proud to have done so. And so thank you for visiting with us.
You're very welcome. Don't you want to mention what's happening to my book?
Oh, well, of course, the big announcement is that we have sold the rights to The Secret Magdalene to Crown Random House, and they will be releasing the hardcover edition in early February of 2007. Congratulations.
Thank you. I'm a little nervous. You know, how it's going to be greeted, but it's very exciting.
I think it's going to be a fabulous success.
Thank you.